Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, and once again, for the final time in this fall of 2024, we are talking about how recruiting works, this time with Delaware head coach Ben DeLuca. Coach DeLuca, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's great to be here, Terry. Thank you for having me. Living the dream here at the University of Delaware and knee deep in moving in a million different directions with practice and recruiting and all the things that, you know, college coaches are doing right now, in addition to, you know, being a husband and a father. So it's been great. Thank you.
It prompts me to thank you for fitting us into what I know is a very busy schedule. So very excited about the conversation. And as has been the case for the prior ones in this series, going to try to structure it in two ways. One, general, second half, a little bit more specific to your situation with the Blue Hens. The general questions, there's one that I actually haven't asked in the last few that I now regret. And it's a fun starting point, which is there's so much about the process of recruiting that is so first and foremost, I think a lot of times evaluation is referred to as recruiting. Recruiting is much more than evaluation. But a lot about evaluation, because it happens in the heat of June and July, or sometimes the brutal wind, rain, and cold of November, it gets associated with this grind and this kind of grudging attitude. So I always love to ask, do you like recruiting? Do you enjoy it?
I do, Terry. I do. I think you're right. It can be characterized as a grind, and there's a lot of work to be done. But I think if you're a hard worker and you're willing, to go out there and put the work in, it can be very rewarding. I love building relationships with young men and families. I love showcasing the University of Delaware and why we feel like it is a special place. And just the excitement of, finding out who's going to be a right fit, for our program. And that part of it is, I think, at the heart of it. You know, you mentioned evaluation is a big piece of it, but when I think about recruiting, I think about, you know, communication, developing relationships with, as I said, young men and families and being authentic about who we are and what we're trying to do and finding the right fits for who wants to be a Blue Hen in the future.
I will fully concede, and that was kind of the point I was trying to make, that developing those relationships and doing that discernment, that work on the back end, is 80% of the job or more. But before moving off of that first 20%, which is deciding whether or not a certain athlete is good enough to play at your level and help your program, just a few more on that topic. How do you describe yourself as an evaluator? How do you describe the way your staff evaluates collectively? And how would you say, with respect to the first question, that's evolved over the course of your career? How do you think that how you evaluate now is different from, say, 15 years ago?
Great question. And listen, thank you for bringing to light this aspect of the sport and having this conversation with me and other coaches, because I think it's exciting to talk about. I'm not sure, how do I describe myself as a recruiter? I think intentional. We really go out and we look for certain things and a certain style of play. We're very open-minded and we're equal opportunity recruiters. We'll go everywhere in North America to go find talent and the right guys. But I also know that we're going out with an understanding of, where we might be able to forge relationships and recruit from and have success from. And we've been fortunate to recruit across the country and up in Canada as well. So, I think we do a good job of spreading a pretty wide net and working hard in those, summer months and fall months that you discuss, of getting to as many events as possible, getting our eyes multiple times on as many kids as we can so that we can have as much data as possible. And then, Matt Rakowski, our associate head coach, and Trey Wilkes, our defensive coordinator, do an unbelievable job of, going out, getting eyes on people, and then we come back, put our heads together, and figure out who's going to be the right fit. We talk a lot about gettability, and that plays a large role in fit, and figuring out, did you see this guy play? We saw him play here. Not to rely on one evaluation, but multiple over the course of time that gives you a better picture of what you're seeing. We have so many different environments in which we recruit. It could be sweltering hot in the summertime. It could be sideways rain in November on a muddy field, turf field, lights, no lights, end of the day, beginning of the day. You know, we do our very best to get out, and we're fortunate with our location to be able to get to a lot of different places. We get out and get as much information as we can, and then come back and put our heads together and figure out what our team needs are, what our, resources are to allocate towards recruiting and go about setting our list and going after that list pretty seriously.
I want to drill down on the notion of seeing an athlete multiple times, because there are other stories where, yeah, we took him sight unseen. We had no idea. It was basically on the recommendation of this individual that we trust. So I guess I see both sides of it. There's also a binary insofar as you cross somebody. There are way more players that you cross off the list than that you circle. And the question is multidirectional, because how frequently would you say that a crossed off player gets back on the list by virtue of seeing him multiple times, versus how much more common is it that a circled player, when you see him second, third, fourth, fifth time, maybe you start to realize that first time was an anomaly?
Yeah, I don't know if I have an equation for you or ratio. It definitely happens. I do know we are very patient in our recruiting in terms of watching somebody. And beauty is in the eye of the beholder. I think that is the bottom line of recruiting, Terry. You and I could go watch an event, and I can walk away with three guys that I loved, and you may not have either not seen them, or they may not have impressed you, and vice versa. You got a couple guys that you thought were lights out, and I may have seen a couple things differently, and that's the human perspective, right? So, we're pretty patient in that, if we watch a kid play and he makes some plays or impresses us and gets on our radar, we want to confirm that. And that's why multiple viewings is important in different conditions. I think it's more likely that a kid that, may need a little bit more work. We like him, but we feel like he's got to, grow or develop or improve in some way, shape, or form, gets back into, our list or our radar for us, than it is the other way around. Likely because, it's easy to identify the top, the cream of the crop, the very top. And, I think that the challenge and the beauty is in between. Very easily who the guys that aren't going to be the right fit. They're not, their athleticism, their skill, maybe it's academics, whatever it may be, that crosses them off the list. That those things are likely not to change. Someone that does get on the list that stands out, and then you're watching them a little bit further, there's confirmation there. And, like I said, the more eyes that we can get on different guys from different perspectives, I don't think we're going to go out and say, Coach Wilkes and I are just going to look at defenders, and Coach Rakowski is just going to look at offensive players, and Coach Kapinos is going to do, faceoffs and goaltenders. We watch everything. And I think as a coach, finding what you like, finding what stands out to you is important, but then getting your heads together and understanding, what the other coaches' opinions are and allowing that discussion in the office is really important. So I guess if I had to pick one or the other, I'd say it's probably more likely that you're put on hold or eliminated than you're added later. You got to take it with a grain of salt, where you're seeing a kid, when you're seeing a kid, who he's playing with. Is the game competitive? Those types of things. But I think that, once a kid is on our list, he makes our list for a reason. If two of us, or even all three or four of us, say, yeah, that guy's, he's the right fit for us, then he's good. If one of us says, I really like this guy, he had a good game, and the other one says, well, I watched him and he didn't do anything, that, gives us an opportunity to say, all right, well, then we need to watch more. And that is something that we do a lot of. We want to watch more. Very rarely is it a, home run, 100%, that's our guy, let's go. Like I said, those guys are easy to find. But the guys that we're looking for that may be the right fit for Delaware, we want to make sure that we're watching them through an extended period of time so that we know what we're getting. And I think that's just the first stage too, Terry. The ability to watch someone on the field is just the first step. You know, that you recognize what their athleticism is, their skill, their talent, their compete level, their grit, their toughness. Those things are great. But then you can get into talking to their coaches about what kind of teammate are they? Do they make people around them better? Do they have humility? Are they leaders? Those types of things. What are they doing in school? You know, those types of things are really important for us, I think. And it's difficult to evaluate character, but that's super important for us here at Delaware. And those are the things that, you know, I think after you get past what type of a player or athlete you are, we try to work really hard to get to know what kind of people you are and also demonstrate to those people who we are. And that's how you build those relationships.
In an effort to try to get a little bit of a clearer picture for the type of player that requires multiple viewings, Owen Grant comes to mind as somebody who I can imagine that you can see him once and say, yeah, we want that player to be a part of our program. Was that the case with him, or even with a guy who ended up being, I guess the second youngest player on the Canadian national team, who obviously ended up not being able to play last summer because he got injured. But still, like, I mean, that is as like, you know, high a claim as you can give relative to what he is as an athlete. How did his process unfold from the standpoint of, was it a no-brainer right away, or was it, we like him, but we want to see more?
It was a no-brainer right away, Terry. That was one of those ones that was really easy. You know, you walk to a field and you watch a lacrosse game, and if you can walk away and say, that's the best person on the field or one of the top three players on the field, you know, you want that guy. That's a hard yes. And I do think that through our evaluations, we do have sort of a standard, you know, it's a yes or no. And then you can get into the finer details of like, all right, he's a yes. Why is he a yes? What are the things that stand out to you with Owen? I mean, size, speed, skill, you know, the compete level, toughness, everything. Like you just jumped out and you said that guy's a game changer. He's a game changer. And you knew it right from the start. And he played on that Everest Academy team that had some really good players too. His good friend Cam Wires. And I think, remembering back to Owen's recruiting process, going to watch those guys play, it was like those two guys were just terrorizing people. And there are others on the team that are really good, both defensively and offensively. But for us, and as a defensive-minded guy and a head coach, that just got me amped. It got me really excited to see what he could do, and walking away saying, "Man, if we have a chance to talk to that young man and bring him here to Delaware, that would be." I mean, it played out almost exactly the way we thought it would. You know, everyone goes through their growing pains, and Owen did as well. You know, when he arrived on campus, he was not the product or the player, the young man that he was when he graduated. And that's, again, we take a lot of pride in our development process, both on and off the field. But he was a no-brainer. I mean, he was one of those guys, I'm sure, that everyone saw him and was like, man, that guy's, he's excellent. I think that, you know, some people may have overlooked him, but certainly not for us.
So that you brought up patience, and that's kind of the last place I want to touch on before we kind of transition into talking more specifically about Delaware from two standpoints. The first is patience with respect to getting multiple evaluations in order to feel more certain in your decision. I'm sure that's true both from the evaluation side as well as the relationship development side, which, you know, we're recording this on September 25th. You're 25 days into developing relationships with a lot of guys who are going to end up being future Blue Hens and some that maybe you haven't even spoken to yet. On the flip side of that is patience with respect to projection, right? So with a player like Owen Grant or Michael Robinson or whomever else, you might say, all right, well, we can see now that this is a player who might be able to come in and contribute as a freshman. But with another percentage of the group, I would imagine more than half, you're recruiting guys who you want to see them as juniors and seniors be at the level to be able to contribute. How is it different trying to, I use the term, see around the corner of what a guy might become relative to what it is, what he is right now? And actually, let me be more specific. Is it easier to project development in somebody who is good all around, but maybe not great at one particular thing, or somebody who is great at one particular thing and doesn't do the other things at the level that need to be done in order to get on the field for you?
Great question. And again, I just appreciate the way that you think about things and the way that you pose the question. And I'll do my best to answer it for you, Terry. I think that patience is super important. And, I'll go back to kind of beauties in the eye of the beholder. It's easy to point out the negatives. It's easy to say, his feet aren't good enough, his stick isn't good enough, he's too small, whatever negatives you want to come up with. And I think we try to go out and hunt the good, hunt the things that stand out to us that are impressive and that we like. And we also know, you mentioned you're watching a junior in high school. That kid, if he comes into practice right away, it's very rare that a high school junior is going to come in and play at the level that college men are playing at, even college young men. So there is that projection, and I think you, at least for me, I rely a lot on the experience that I've had as a coach, on experiences that I've had with young men that have developed, whether they're from non-traditional hotbeds or, they're a little bit on the smaller side or a little bit on the slower side or a little bit, on the, just that you, there, every player goes into college with deficiencies. And I think those are easy to pick out. What you have to determine as a coaching staff is, can we change those? Can we improve them, or can we accentuate the good things that player brings to the table to cover up for the weaknesses? Can we pair them with a player that, there's some synergy, that they play well together? And, that's the art. I think there's plenty of times where people feel like this is a home run recruit, no question. And that he or she just doesn't develop the way that maybe you thought they might. And I have a million and one stories of the opposite, of young guys that have flown under the radar, not really well, known in the recruiting process, and then they come to college and they play really well, and coaches and people are saying, like, where'd you find that guy? Like, where'd he come from? And I think there's a lot of internal drive in that regard, and the competitiveness that we're looking for, the compete level. Some kids plateau. Some kids, they play lacrosse year round. They work with trainers and this and that, and they're playing at a very high level as a high school player, but their capacity to grow and improve may not be as great as a multiple sport athlete or a guy who, picks up a sport in a different season that doesn't play year round. And that was me, Terry. And I think that, as a young guy, I came to lacrosse very late in life. I was much more of a football and a basketball player. And, I take that into consideration when I'm looking at kids as well, especially from non-traditional hotbeds. But, the patience with it is, do you see what your staff sees as well? There's a certain amount as a head coach that I'll say, hey, that guy, that's a yes. Like, we want to talk to him. Let's figure out how he fits. But oftentimes it's putting our heads together and collaborating as a coaching staff and saying, all right, here's our cohort. Who fits where? And what's our greatest need? You may love, a lefty attackman who's filling up the back of the net, but if you have a Mike Robinson on your team, that may not be your biggest need. Or again, a big rangy defenseman like Owen Grant. If you have one of those, is it great to have two? Sure, sometimes, but other times you might need someone else. And Owen did what he benefited from with his teammates, helping him through a lot of his growth in college and understanding of the game. I got a hilarious story about Ty Kurtz too, who, we recruited him based on seeing him very little. And those guys, sometimes those Canadians don't come south very often to play down here. And we had a chance to see him and his brother play with a 3D Georgia team. I think he got connected with a 3D Georgia team and just played lights out. And we recruited him, went through that process, really enjoyed the family. And he came down here, and in our very first game, he's running through the crease and he's checking the goalie, and he's, just didn't understand the rules of the game. And we're looking at each other on the sidelines like, man, is this the guy? Right. And the answer is yes. He just needed to be taught. And he was as hard a worker and as tough a player as we've ever coached. And he was in the office studying film and learning. And, like, if he did it
once. Reading the rule
once,
book.
yeah, if he did it once and you're like, hey, you can't do that, he'd be like, oh, okay. Like, all right. But he wanted to learn and grow. He was very competitive in that regard. But, a guy who broke our all-time scoring record came in his first game I don't want to say it was a mess, but it was kind of like, whoa, he was starting for us, but, there was a lot of things where, like, we got to work with this kid. And credit to him, and the other guys on the team for working their tails off, learning, taking the coaching, working on their own. And listen, he developed into an all-time great for us at Delaware, and is having a tremendous amount of success both indoors and outdoors as a pro. So, you know, again, looking around the corner, it's super challenging. And anyone who says that, yeah, I knew 100% that this guy was going to do this probably isn't being fully honest. A lot of it is that chemistry once they get to campus, and the way are they willing to work? You can have the best athlete with the best skills, and if he's not willing to work and improve and really love the process, he's probably not going to get out of it what he wants to. But you know, again, that's part of for us how we evaluate and the things that we dig into when we get to the tail end of the recruiting process of are we going to offer them and are we going to really go after someone sincerely, or are we going to kind of pass and look in another direction?
Let's transition to talking about Delaware even a little bit more specifically than we already have. One of the elements of the program that I think just it is at the intersection of so many different aspects of college lacrosse and college athletics. And, you know, the geography almost kind of represents that right on the middle of North and South. Right. But it's kind of in the middle between big school and small school. It's in, the middle between, you know, elite academics, but also, attainable for, somebody who might not necessarily have, a pristine transcript coming out. It has tremendous history in terms of, success and producing all Americans and pros. But at the same time, not a perennial powerhouse where it's a fait accompli that you're going to be playing in the NCAA tournament. So how does that manifest in a pitch, quote unquote, specifically when you're talking to somebody who has a lot of options and might not necessarily be coming to the table thinking that Delaware is going to be the best fit for him, and it's your job to show him why it is?
I'll tell you the biggest thing, Terry, is getting kids on campus, you know, and I think you hit the nail on the head. You know, we came here and Delaware has always been known as a little bit of a sleeping giant or a diamond in the rough or a hidden gem. And we're working really hard to change that based on the work that we're putting in and the things that our program has done over the last, you know, several years. And I think without a doubt, when people step on campus, there's a reaction of like, wow, I didn't know it was like this. I didn't know it looked like this. I didn't know the environment was like this. It's surprising to a lot of people because, you know, Delaware has an international reputation. You know, we're the first school to have a study abroad program in the United States, and the Delaware name is internationally recognizable, and it's nationally recognizable, excuse me, as well. But I also think that being in the middle of all these hotbeds between Maryland and Pennsylvania and New Jersey and New York and close by, a lot of bigger, you know, higher branded schools, you know, have that advantage. But once people get on campus and take a look around and talk with us, they recognize, and you mentioned this earlier, Terry, like we have everything that anyone else is offering as well. Maybe not to the extreme, but, you know, certainly competitively. You know, our facilities are competitive with any in the country. Our tradition is competitive. Our alumni are phenomenal in terms of their support of the program. So getting them on campus is a big part of it. Just showing them what Delaware is all about, because a lot of people don't know what the lacrosse program is about. And also, I think it's important to recognize the evolution of the program and the university. You know, Delaware has grown tremendously, you know, academically and athletically over the course of its history, to the point where now we're transitioning into the FBS in Conference USA with football and basketball and other sports at a pretty, you know, exciting time. And I think that's also a recognition of we're ready. We're ready to be, you know, considered and compared against, you know, the best of the best. So, you know, you come in and you get a feel for the coaches, you get a feel for the players, you get a feel for, you know, what the experience here is at Delaware. And we're confident that that experience stacks up with any in the country. And a lot of people, you know, see that as well. So, you know, I think that getting on campus, and getting your feet on the ground is a big part of it. A lot of people drive up and down 95 and you see the sign as you're driving by, you know, exit 1A or 1B, you know, University of Delaware, but they don't get off and come through. And sometimes it's for, you know, a tournament or a game, but not necessarily getting on the green and getting in the academic part of campus or getting on Main Street for a meal. And those things are all important to underscore, you know, what a classic American college experience you can have here at Delaware.
Whether it's North Carolina, Virginia, Maryland, Penn State, Rutgers, Ohio State, Michigan now, maybe even a little bit of University of Denver, Cornell, or Syracuse, winning at home, right, and keeping, recruiting in-state is important. Delaware, small state, state with improving lacrosse, whether it be down on the beach, certainly in Wilmington, or a lot of Delaware residents who go to school at private schools just across the line into Pennsylvania. What's it been like, and what is your staff's approach to recruiting Delaware residents?
Oh, we recruit the state hard, really hard. We want the best talent to stay home, and you make a great point, Terry. There's some great programs down in the beaches. You know, Cape Henlopen has been dominant, you know, for a long time down in Lewis. Caesar Rodney has a great program, you know, and then you have some of the private schools like Salesianum and Archmere and others that compete at a very high level. And it's interesting that because we are a smaller state. And we have borders with Maryland and Pennsylvania, and we're extremely close to New Jersey as well. A lot of residents from those states can come into schools here, private schools here, in particularly in Newcastle County, in the northern part of the state, and compete. And so we're looking at all the teams here in the state, and we want to keep, you know, the homegrown talent here, you know, to represent the 302 as we talk about it. And we've been successful in a lot of ways. Tom Alo was a guy who was a captain for us, you know, an offensive player in high school, a short stick when we got to campus here in 2018, and we put a pole in his hands, and he was fantastic for us. Just an unbelievable athlete, competitor, captain, leader. He just graduated from dental school. You know, he's a fantastic student. You know, and guys like that, and, you know, Hank D'Ambrosi is one example right now, coming up from the Cape Henlopen program. So we work really hard, whether it's a private school or a public school. We really want to have Delaware's finest stay here. I do think that, you know, there's a little bit of a double-edged sword, and that a lot of, you know, kids from Delaware, because it's a small state, do want to explore other options and go a little bit further away from home, which you don't have to go far to find a lot of great options. But, you know, it is a priority for us and a focus of ours to keep, you know, the best talent in Delaware home. But again, it does, a lot of it comes down to the fit. Not everyone that plays in the state of Delaware is a fit for the program here at the University of Delaware. There's a lot of, you know, kids that go other places and have success at other places. But we work hard to get the right guys from the state here. And even if they're Pennsylvania or Maryland or New Jersey guys that are going to school in Delaware, we're still trying to get those guys to come down and take a look. And I think we've had a reasonable amount of success doing that.
No doubt. You mentioned the transition to FBS, and, you know, Delaware football has been a national champion and produced NFL players at the FCS level. And this is part of a wave of change in college athletics that is impossible to forecast and very difficult even to summarize. You know, just this week we've had movement within the Pac-12 with respect to their relationship with the Mountain West. What has it been like, and how has it affected the tenor within the department? And then I want to ask a few more specific questions. Sure. About some of the general things that I think Delaware represents.
It's exciting. It's super exciting. I think it does. And you mentioned Delaware being in a very unique position compared to our peers in a lot of different ways. And I think this, you know, kind of feeds right into it. The infrastructure is there. You know, you have to give a ton of credit to the leadership here, the alignment from the Board of Trustees to President Asanas to Christy Raywalk, our AD, the vision. Nothing is done here on a whim, you know, or sporadically. It is very well thought out. And I mentioned the word intentional. That is something that is discussed a lot here. On what we're doing and how we're doing and how we're positioning ourselves. And we want to position Delaware to be at the very top eventually when the time is right. So it's exciting to understand that, you know, the transition is going to happen up to Conference USA. It's certainly a little nerve wracking for us. And, you know, as a lacrosse program, Conference USA does not sponsor lacrosse. So we went through a transition period of, all right, you know, are we going to stay in the CAA? Or are we going to move to a different conference? And there's a lot of conversations there, and we're extremely excited to be a member of the A-10, in the 2026 season. I think that's a super competitive conference with great schools. And, you know, for us, it's all about kind of competing at the highest level where we are and positioning ourselves to be ready for what's next. I liken it a lot, Terry, to we talked about being a role, the importance of role players, maybe before we started recording. And you know, we talk to our guys all the time, everyone in the locker room, everyone's got an important role to play. And everybody wants to start. Everybody wants to be an impact player. But a team isn't a great team without phenomenal role players. And we talk to our guys about, you know, starring in the role that you have, but working for the role that you want. And I think that's sort of bleeds through into our program as well. We want to star where we are. We want to be great where we are, but also prepare ourselves and position ourselves for any type of potential movement that may happen in the very uncertain future of college athletics as we move forward.
So a couple of the specific elements of the way in which the college athletics landscape has changed and is currently changing. So we'll go chronologically. In July 1st, 2021, the outcome of several either legal rulings, judicial rulings, or legislation led to the NCAA allowing athletes to profit off their name, image, and likeness. That quickly gave way to the notion of collectives, whereby the structure of the relationship between a brand and an athlete evolved and developed. And then it's, in my opinion, settled into a little bit of a stasis over the course of the last year or two. There have been some elements that have evolved, including injunction as part of a case that Virginia and Tennessee brought against the NCAA about utilizing NIL as a means of inducement. And I think it's fair to say that the proposed House settlement, which is now being revised, was intended to further evolve and, in my opinion, diminish the power of collectives relative to some of the ways in which athletes could be compensated. That is a very, very brief summary of something that is very broad and difficult to summarize. There hasn't been a ton about the way in which NIL has affected lacrosse. My opinion is because I think generally the perception is overstated. It hasn't affected lacrosse as much as the perception is that it has affected lacrosse. What is your opinion of the role that NIL dollars have played in the sport, be it for athletes on rosters or in recruiting?
What a great question. First of all, let me just say that your cerebration is incredibly impressive in the way that you think about, you know, the sport and athletics in general and kind of bring it to our sport of lacrosse is impressive, Terry. So I'm going to do my very best to follow that question. I think I got it. But, I think it's very much undetermined. I agree with you that, you know, it's natural to look at football and basketball and some of the publicity that those athletes are getting with some of the NIL deals that are happening for, you know, a quarterback at, you know, in the SEC or a wide receiver or a point guard or, you know, some of those high profile athletes that are, you know, able to take advantage of some monster, what seem like monster NIL deals. But then there's also stories of, you know, kids committing in football to NIL deals that get pulled. You know, like, hey, I'm going there because they offered me the best NIL deal, and then you show up and it's like, yeah, that money's not here because whether it's the business or the owner or the collective has decided, yep, we actually allocated our money somewhere else, and then those kids are kind of hung out to dry. But those are the headlines. Those are the things that you read in the paper and you see in the news. And then, you know, lacrosse athletes are saying, like, well, geez, if they're doing that, then I should be in the range, or I should, you know, that's what it's like. And there's a little bit of a wild, wild west of, you know, no one knows what anyone else is doing. You know, I think there's a general perception and understanding, but the really getting down to brass tacks of what is happening is still very cloudy and murky. And with the House settlement or the what's happening in the legislation there, you know, there's, you know, the 48-man roster and the unlimited scholarships. And, you know, you mentioned earlier, too, the collectives that are outside of the institution, there's movement to bring those into the institution. And does a head coach's role become more like a general manager's role where you have a, you know, you have a certain amount of money that you're allocated by the university and you can distribute it as you see fit? Because they're definitely not, they're not going to go back on athlete earning power. That cat's out of the bag. That bell has been rung. So it's more along the lines of how do you create a system that works and there can be accountability for, the mission of what a student athlete is really, I guess, supposed to be doing or was doing back in the day of pursuing an education, playing a sport helps them achieve a degree and an experience that otherwise they wouldn't be able to enjoy. It is impacting it, though it is a factor, but I don't think it's as big a factor. I agree with you. I don't think it's as big a factor as people are making it out to be. And I know there's a lot of misinformation out there. So-and-so got this and so-and-so is offering this or whatnot. And, you know, who's confirming that? Who's corroborating that? Like, you just don't know. And that's where we rely on direct and honest communication, you know, for us of like, this is what we're able to do. This is what we think in the process that we're having. I rely a lot on our AD, Chrissy Raywalk, and her leadership. We talk a lot with our coaches here at Delaware, all coaches, of what it's like in their sports, how they're handling it, how they're managing it. And, you know, and we're doing our very best to stay on the cutting edge, you know, not necessarily right at the front, but certainly not in the rear. You know, I think we try to be right in the middle, not diving headfirst into a shallow pool, more wading in and seeing like, all right, how are some schools using it, operating? How are they finding success? Is there something that can translate here to Delaware that is a good idea that we might be able to use, and other things that are just completely outlandish and not realistic? So it's a factor. I mean, money's important for a lot of families. But I also think that there's a lot of education that needs to happen with regard to all the, you know, complexities around what it means. You know, taxes, you have to have an accountant, you have to, you know, account for what the taxes are, what is actually going in your pocket versus what, you know, is being promised could be two completely different things.
You mentioned the House settlement, and I'm going to do the same thing I just did with respect to NIL and characterize my opinion and or point of view on where it currently sits, and then, you know, hopefully ask a clear and direct question. So the NCAA, in conjunction, though there's some dispute over how much conjunction, with the plaintiff's attorneys, proposed a settlement to a judge that was supposed to settle not just the House case, but two other cases of similar comport in different jurisdictions. That happened at the end of July. The NCAA announced what the terms of that settlement would be. 2 weeks ago, the judge, Claudia Wilkin, of the case, who has handled a lot of these cases over the course of the last 15 years or so between the NCAA and athletes who were aggrieved or seeking damages, sent it back to the attorneys such that what was in that proposal can no longer be assumed as what was going to come to fruition. And there's a lot of unclarity as a result. What was interesting was that in late July and early August, the way in which my impression of how a lot of people interpreted the proposal, the news of the proposal, was that these are the rules of the road going forward, right? Like everybody is going to have a 48-man roster limit. Everybody is going to be able to offer as many scholarships as they want to. And that means everybody's getting 48. Everybody, we got 48-man rosters and everybody's getting a full ride. That was never going to happen, and it's not going to happen. But also, it was never going to happen because the settlement was only actually adherent to members of the four conferences that were defendants in the case, which were the Power Four conferences, which even as you join Conference USA, Conference USA has not won, which meant that the NCAA was going to have to come up with a rule structure where what those four conferences adhered to, their members adhered to, was not less than, but it could have exceeded, right? Such as, like, the Conference USA could have said, well, we're not going to set a 48-person roster limit, but if we want to set a roster limit, we could do 52 or 55 or whatever the case may be. But they couldn't do 47. It's essentially the way I interpreted that. All of that is a way to ask this question. With respect to NIL and this notion of full scholarships and this notion of roster caps. Have athletes and parents over the last month been asking you, like, oh, I thought I was just going to get a full scholarship, or, oh, I thought you were only going to be able to recruit 12 players because you're going to have a 48-man roster, or, hey, what kind of NIL opportunity do you have that's available? I guess that last question is actually much more reasonable than the first two. What have the conversations been like?
Some of that, not all of that, certainly inquiring about the roster limit and size of recruiting class has been a very common question. I think there's a lot of rumblings out there that coaches are intentionally taking smaller classes because of, you know, forecasting a potential 48-man roster cap. But again, then you see, you know, coaches that are programs that are bringing in 15, 16, you know, big classes. I just think there's so much uncertainty and unknown. And the other point that you made is, you know, with that settlement, my understanding is that you either opt in or you opt out. You know, like you have to, you know, opt in or opt out. And you may not have a choice if you're in the, you know, those Power Four or autonomous conferences of you were opting in. That's the driving force behind it. But what does that mean for, you know, in our sport, there's, you know, a couple programs that are, you know, grandfathered in at Division III institutions competing at the Division I level. There are institutions that don't have high-level football or high-level basketball. Are those schools going to opt in as well? And if they don't opt in, you know, what are the playing rules? Like, what does that look like? Are you going to have a certain cohort operating by a certain set of rules and standards and another not? You know, I don't have answers for you on that. I think we're all kind of waiting to figure out how the chips fall and what it's going to be. But in terms of the conversations that we're having, yes, there are those conversations of, you know, what's the size of your class looking like, and are there NIL opportunities? And listen, we are extremely fortunate to have a very supportive alumni group and booster group that is positioning us to operate in that space, which is very, very fortunate for us. So we're doing the best we can to be smart about, you know, what we have and how we're allocating it, and also projecting what may happen down the line. I mean, ultimately, and you mentioned it, nothing has been settled. So, you know, some people may be making promises that they can't keep down the line because the rules are going to change, but that's not stopping them right now from saying, hey, no one stopped me from doing this now. And I want to, you know, I want to get the guys that I want to get, and we're going to do it this way. So I just think that the reverberations and the ripple effect are going to be pretty impressive when everything gets settled. I also, again, just in our sport, knowing that we are essentially riding the wave of football and basketball and they're the driving engine of what's causing this change. You know, how do we learn from what they're doing? How do we adopt some of the tactics and the things that they're using to recruit and retain? Because I think it's two parts. It's not just getting kids to commit and to come, but it's then keeping them there. And you know, I know there's a lot of conversation amongst our coaching group here at Delaware of, like, you know, if the rules are what they may be, where, you know, there's unlimited transfers and you can play right away, and you can have 5 years of eligibility. If you have an athlete that goes to five different schools, he just jumps from he commits to the best NIL deal coming out of high school. And then after his freshman year, he goes in the portal, takes the next best NIL deal and just kind of continues to move. Where's he getting his degree from? You know, who's, you know, where do you say that you played versus the, you know, I'm just collecting as much money as I can until I go somewhere else. I think there's a lot of coaches, particularly in our sport, that are very interested in developing kids and developing a culture and a team that impacts guys for the rest of their lives. And that's becoming more and more difficult if, you know, there's so many transfers and there's so much movement. So I think, you know, different coaches have different answers and solutions about what they're doing and how they're doing it. I think for us, as I mentioned earlier, we are very observant and trying to be very aware of what others are doing or what we're hearing is happening in other places and trying to apply best practices to what we're doing. But ultimately, you know, I guess at its core, Terry, we want young men and families to choose Delaware because of us in Delaware, not necessarily because it's the most amount of money or the least expensive option. And, you know, that may be changing very quickly based on, you know, the commercialization that's happening and the money that's getting involved.
I want to get you out here on this then. how do you describe how the last month has unfolded, and how do you describe what you're trying to do with your 26 class in terms of putting together a group that's going to help win you A10 championships?
Yeah, we're excited. It's been going great. I think it's always a roller coaster. You build these relationships, you get invested with kids, and when they tell you yes, you're super excited and thrilled. And if they say they're going in a different direction, there's a sense of sadness or frustration, but you move on, because what we do is we work really hard, Terry, to try and put ourselves in the shoes of the recruit and the parents, right? As a father of two young kids, my staff, Coach Rook has three, and Coach Wilkes has a one-year-old. if we're fortunate at some point in time to be sitting in the chair that they're sitting in and talking to coaches, we're very hopeful that we're going to find someone who's going to be as honest and authentic and real about the process as we are. And you invest in those relationships, and when they come your way, it's awesome. And when they don't, it's sad. So there's a little bit of a roller coaster of like, oh man, that stinks. I really would have liked to have had that guy. But ultimately I do think the process plays out the way it should. And we're on the hunt. We're on the hunt. We're having some great conversations. We're having great visits. There's a lot of excitement around the program and around the department in general, as we talked about with the transition to Conference USA and our transition to the A10. But it's interesting. You kind of toggle back and forth from developing the team and preparing to compete in the CAA this year in our final year in the CAA, and also recruiting and preparing for the transition to the A10 and what that's going to look like. So you kind of have to have a lot of different hats when you're a head coach and a coaching staff at this stage.
Well, then we will let you get back to it. Coach DeLuca, really appreciate your time. Best of luck as you continue to develop this 26 class and get your team that's on campus ready for the 25 season. Can't wait to see the Hens this fall and then in February when the games count for real.
Yeah, Terry, thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. Go Hens.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.